Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, views, history, and information. This week, I'll have four readings. I have a New York Times story about the Gullah Geechee, information about a new bookstore organization from Publishers Weekly. I'm going to wrap up the program with an essay about author Jamaica Kincaid from the New York Review of Books. And I'm starting with this. Why all black rodeo events are so hot right now. This was written by Mark Ramirez and published August 9, 2025 in the USA Today newspaper. Call it the Beyoncé effect. One of America's biggest music superstars unleashed a stampede of excitement for black rodeos across the country with her 2024 album, Cowboy Carter. Nowhere is that more obvious than tiny Okmulgee, Oklahoma, home to the nation's oldest continuously operated black rodeo. When Beyoncé released that country album, she told black people it's okay to wear cowboy boots and cowboy hats, said Danelle Tipton, a champion bull rider who now serves as arena director for multiple state rodeos, including what is now the Okmulgee Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo. Tipton said, I haven't seen so many black girls in cowboy hats and boots, ever. We've had our rodeos, but city slickers were never in tune with it. Now it's like the floodgates opened. On the weekend of August 9th, the Okmulgee Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo marks its 70th year, the legacy of 24 black businessmen, farmers, and ranchers frustrated with the second-class treatment accorded to black rodeo competitors and their fans in the 1950s. Tipton has been attending the Okmulgee Rodeo ever since he was a kid, riding along with his family's roundup club, the Oklahoma City Paraders. The equestrian-minded community organization held weekend parades to precede black rodeo competitions in rural outposts around the state, in places like Tatum's, Clearview, and Drumright. Okmulgee was always the last rodeo of the year, he said. It was like our Super Bowl. Situated 40 miles south of Tulsa, the Okmulgee Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo is among the country's largest black sporting events, according to event producer Kenneth LeBlanc. In 1956, LeBlanc's father Roy and grandfather Charles were among the founders of what was then called the Okmulgee County Roundup Club. Black people couldn't get into white rodeos, said Marcus Friday, who has been the Okmulgee events announcer for 2 decades. That's why they started the rodeo. Who would have thought that 70 years later, it's still going? Okmulgee is among a patchwork of black rodeo circuit events that thrived in the 1950s and 60s throughout the Texas Gulf Coast region and the area around Tulsa, according to Keith Ryan Cartwright, author of Black Cowboys of Rodeo, Unsung Heroes from Harlem to Hollywood and the American West. A lot of black rodeo cowboys got their start in one of these two areas, said Cartwright, who now serves as assistant general manager of the Nashville Stampede, a pro bull riding team. Maybe they weren't from there, but they would migrate there in order to compete regularly. Nearly an hour to the west, the Boley, Oklahoma Rodeo is the oldest of all black rodeos, dating back to 1903. But with several interpretations along the way. Okmulgee has clung to its annual tradition like a bull rider refusing to be bucked off. This is the 70th year, and there's no asterisk, Carter said. They even found a way to have it in 2020. The 2025 events features more than 200 competitors, including dozens of calf ropers, team ropers, steer wrestlers, and barrel racers. The atmosphere bears little resemblance to the big-money, corporate-sponsored spectacles broadcast on television. It's not some multi-million-dollar production, Cartwright said. It's old school. The rodeo's inaugural run was held north of town on leased land owned by the local white Roundup Club, Tipton said. When the club saw the event's success and significantly raised the rates the next year, the organizers of the budding black rodeo decided it was time to find their own venue and bought 40 acres south of town, he said. That's where the Okmulgee Invitational Rodeo was held until 1991, he said, when the all-black event moved to the Bob Arrington Rodeo Arena owned by the Muscogee Creek Nation. By that time, Tipton was starting to compete himself, riding bulls and wrestling steers. In 1998, he was named the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association's Bull Riding and Overall Rookie of the Year. Coming up in the pro ranks, Tipton said, fellow black cowboys were a rare sight. Even now, he said, when he goes to events on the East or West Coast, they're like, wow, black cowboys. They see white cowboys competing on TV every day. Among the barriers, Tipton said, were finances and unfamiliarity with the logistical strategies necessary to qualify for the national finals, which are based on prize money won throughout the year. Competitors must navigate a network of seasonal events held across the country to finish among the top 15 qualifiers in their respective categories. There's so many black cowboys who should be making tons of money, Tipton said. A lot don't know the business side. So when they come back to black rodeo, there's a home for them. When he found success as a rookie and hit the pro circuit, Tipton said, he didn't return to the black rodeo circuit for several years, but he always made sure to return for Okmulgee. He wasn't the only one. Many of the black rodeo greats throughout the years have frequented Okmulgee. Among them, Mertis Dykman, often referred to as the Jackie Robinson of rodeo. Dykman was among those featured during Beyoncé's Christmas Day halftime show during the Houston Texans game against the Baltimore Ravens in December. He was the first African-American to qualify for the National Finals Rodeo, said Friday, the event announcer. He never won a world title, but he's the one who actually opened the doors for African-American cowboys in rodeo today. Dykman grew up on a ranch in Crockett, Texas, 2 hours north of Houston, where his father was a ranch hand and his mother helped work the fields, Cartwright said. He went to school when ranch work allowed, never learning to read. As a young man, Dykman found work as a rodeo clown and bullfighter, but knew he had the skills to be an accomplished bull rider, Cartwright said. Like other black rodeo hopefuls, he often wouldn't be allowed to ride until events were over. He quickly established himself not as a great black bull rider, but as a great bull rider, Cartwright said. Eventually, the humble and well-liked Dykman would earn his way onto the circuit with other cowboys eager to compete against him. In the 1960s, Cartwright said, standards called for only 2 event judges, and all it took was 1 to poison a competitor's chances for success. It wasn't so egregious as to make them finish last, he said. All they had to do was rob them of a point here or there. But spread over the course of a season, Cartwright said, those sprinklings of bias had their effect, depriving certain competitors of prize money and dropping them several places in the standings. He believes that happened to Dykman and others. Dykman realized that despite whatever slights he might face, he could still claw his way to the finals if he competed in enough events to earn sufficient prize money. He avoided southern rodeos and instead hit events in Texas, Oklahoma, on the West Coast, and throughout the Midwest and Rust Belt. He thought, there's always going to be a judge that isn't going to let me win in an event. But if over the course of a season I go to more events than anyone else, all my second places and fourth places will get me there, Cartwright said. He hustled and was very methodical. In 1967 and 68, Dykman finished among the 3 or 4 top-ranked bull riders in the world. While he never won the sports gold buckle, Dykman knew he had accomplished something special, Cartwright said. I can't stress enough how good he had to be to finish third at a time when our country was facing the racial animus it did, he said. He said to me, I wanted to be a world champion, but I never were a world champion. But I was a world champion as a man. He wasn't bragging on himself. What he was saying was that he saw something that hadn't been done and he wanted to do it and did everything he could to do it. I just find him to be heroic. In February, Tipton and Friday teamed up to produce their 2nd annual National Black Cowboy Rodeo Awards and Gala in Oklahoma City. We've honored all the old cowboys the last 2 years, Tipton said. Dykman, now 90, was among them. So was Charles Sampson, the former kid from Watts, California, who, with Dykman's mentorship, became the first black bull rider to win a rodeo world title in 1982. Both have been among the luminaries who polished their craft at Okmulgee. Murtis and Charlie are legends, Cartwright said. Not just among black cowboys, they're legendary rodeo cowboys, period. Before a bull rider's bucking chute opens, there is someone there to tighten the rope he'll use to hold on to for the duration of the ride. And riders are notoriously picky about who gets to do it, Cartwright said. When Charlie won the world title in the 10th round, Murtis was there, and Charlie had him pull his bull rope for him, he said. For him to wave off the guy who would normally pull his rope and let Murtis do it goes to show that Charlie understood the significance of this moment and that the road to that moment was paved by Murtis. It's on that foundation that today's young black cowboys will build on when they compete this weekend in Okmulgee. Okmulgee originated at a time when it was needed, Cartwright said. There was nowhere else for them to go. It's a historic event. That was the article, Why All Black Rodeo Events Are So Hot Right Now. It was written by Mark Ramirez and published August 9, 2025 in USA Today newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is from the New York Times newspaper and is about the Gullah Geechee people of South Carolina. The title is Class and Identity in Hilton Head, The Gullah versus Wealthy Landowners. This was written by Clyde McGrady and published July 28, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, A legal fight over access to burial grounds has pitted the Gullah Geechee against wealthy landowners around Hilton Head Island. When Galen Miller wants to visit the South Carolina cemetery where much of his ancestry is buried, he must get permission to enter Hilton Head Plantation, a private, gated community on the north end of Hilton Head Island, where the wealthy jostle for tea times between trips to the beach and sips of gin and tonics. On a recent July morning, a guard waved Mr. Miller through the gate. He meandered past multi-million dollar homes and lush green fairways to the Tall Birds Cemetery, now squeezed between a scenic creek and a luxury condominium. To be able to come here and visit my family from time to time, it really touches your heart, Mr. Miller said. It also saddens you to see what's happening. Mr. Miller is Gullah Geechee, a community descended from enslaved West Africans who were forced to work the cotton and rice plantations of the Carolina Low Country. The Gullah Geechee are now struggling to preserve sacred traditions as wealthy northerners swallow up valuable waterfront property. A lawsuit filed this spring is accusing the mostly white newcomers, spilling out of gated golf havens in the original Hilton Head developments, of impeding access to burial grounds in a clash of tradition and economic development, with racial undertones that date back centuries. Oh my God, we went through enough, said Arlene Covington, a plaintiff in the lawsuit. Now we can't even get to the cemetery. What else do you want? For decades, Mary Mack, 73, would visit the Big House Cemetery on St. Helena Island, South Carolina, home to one of the region's largest remaining Gullah populations. But in 2023, a newly arrived local resident, Teresa Aigner, placed a gate around her property, blocking access to Everest Road, which leads to the cemetery. Miss Aigner provided a gate access code to the Gullah and to funeral homes that needed to get to the Big House Cemetery. But in May 2024, when several Gullah families arrived for the annual Mother's Day cleanup, the code had been changed. According to the lawsuit filed by the Bailey Law Firm and the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of Miss Mack and several other Gullah. It was kind of shocking, Miss Mack said. The Gullah tried, to no avail, to persuade Miss Aigner to give them access. So if I want to see my mom back there, I have to talk to you, Miss Covington asked rhetorically. I am not a child. The tipping point came later that month, when five local black residents died in a car crash. With their families unable to reach the cemetery, some of them were interred 20 miles away. The public and private acrimony that followed captured a larger debate over land use and gentrification raging on St. Helena Island as developers looked to expand beyond an almost saturated Hilton Head. In one email exchange between a land preservation activist and Ms. Aigner, the new landowner referred to the local Gullah Geechee as a bunch of ungrateful, ungracious, self-entitled, hard-headed, and ignorant people, to whom she owes nothing, according to the legal complaint. The lawsuit filed April 30th in the gracious old city of Beaufort, South Carolina, also names two other defendants, Robert Cody Harper and Walter Robert Harper, Jr., who erected a gate on property that abuts the cemetery. Ms. Aigner has said that she put up the gate to protect her property after a funeral procession left it damaged. "I am so tired of being villainized," she told the Island Packet, a local outlet, last year. She also insisted that there were other ways to reach the cemetery besides going through her property, including through property owned by a plaintiff in the case. Indeed, her attorney, Greg Alford, filed a motion on July 18th to dismiss the lawsuit. The motion states that the individual plaintiffs already have direct, platted, and judicially protected access to the cemetery parcel which they claim to own and control. Sheila Middleton, another plaintiff, owns the property on which the cemetery sits, according to the lawsuit. Mr. Alford also argued that Everest Road was not the most convenient route to the cemetery. "We look forward to resolving this matter," said Mr. Alford, who also represents the Harpers. "We want them to be able to honor their ancestors." While not a part of their official legal complaint, lawyers for the Gullah descendants say county officials are trying to prevent the types of cultural clashes exemplified by this lawsuit. Beaufort County, which includes St. Helena Island, has actually enacted provisions as part of its cultural protection overlay that prohibits putting up fences and gates around communities to block access to cemeteries on the island, said Emily Early of the Center for Constitutional Rights. "These gates can disrupt generations-old practices of visiting and caring for burial grounds, preventing families from performing important spiritual and memorial traditions. For Black South Carolinians, the Lowcountry is a place of unfulfilled promises. Its land fell under General William T. Sherman's January 15, 1865, Special Field Orders 15, made famous by the pledge of 40 acres and a mule to the freedmen. The order, reserved and set apart for the settlement of the Negroes now made free as a result of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation. The islands from Charleston south, the abandoned rice fields along the rivers for 30 miles back from the sea, and the country bordering the St. John's River, Florida. Before that year was out, President Andrew Johnson had pardoned the region's white landowners, who then kicked black people out. St. Helena became a staging ground for Reconstruction. In 1861, Union troops occupied the Sea Islands and enslavers fled. A group of idealistic, Harvard-educated Bostonians arrived to educate the formerly enslaved and proved they could thrive as free people. It was known as the Port Royal Experiment. The freedmen worked the same fields as enslaved people, and they came to own these lands during the Civil War, said Robert L. Adams, Jr., director of the Penn Center, a cultural site on St. Helena in what was once a school for the formerly enslaved. But in the 1950s, a developer named Charles Fisher had a vision for Hilton Head Island as a top tourist destination. Through a combination of underpriced sales, property tax hikes, and unfavorable property inheritance rules, the Gullah lost most of their land. Gullah families once owned more than 3,500 acres on Hilton Head Island, according to the nonprofit Lowcountry Gullah. They now own less than 700 acres. Dr. Adams says he sees the Gullah's fight as part of the larger battles over race, identity, and wealth that are roiling the country. "Democracy is not just about who has the money," he said. "Too often, public policy has relegated African Americans to being placeholders of land. So we occupy land that's considered unuseful until people find a way to make it useful again, or they can buy it really cheap." Earlier this month, Taiwan Scott, age 49, who has a real estate license but considers himself more of a Gullah activist, gestured to the set of beachfront houses on Hilton Head Island. Pretty much where all these oceanfront homes are was all black land, he said. They used to have a couple of nightclubs down there. Many of the Gullah who were once there now live inland in neighborhoods dotted with trailer homes. But Mr. Scott has complicated feelings about development. Newcomers on Hilton Head Island are increasingly professing their own anti-development sentiment, he said, pulling up the drawbridge just as Gullah people are becoming aware of their property rights and how to make money from the new plots of land they still own. Efforts are underway to educate more Gullah about land rights, said Alex Brown, a Gullah who sits on the Hilton Head Island Town Council, so that if development does come to the island surrounding Hilton Head, such as St. Helena, they can take advantage. For instance, instead of selling their land outright, Mr. Brown recommended that the Gullah with valuable waterfront property lease it to developers and share in the profits. Mr. Brown recently stood in the middle of the 18th fairway at Harbor Town Golf Links on Hilton Head Island under a blazing high noon sun. The 18th is the final hole on the RBC Heritage Classic, a PGA Tour event held the week after the Masters tournament in Augusta, Georgia. The fairway sits less than 100 yards from a Gullah gravesite. Newcomers arrive with little understanding or respect for the island's deep Gullah cultural roots, he said, which are the heart and soul of the island. Some residents are unaware that Gullah people even exist on the island. Unless it's us from the Gullah culture telling the story, Mr. Brown said, there's no mention of the significance of a burial ground that goes back two centuries. That was the article, Class and Identity in Hilton Head, The Gullah versus Wealthy Landowners. This was written by Clyde McGrady and published July 28, 2025 in the New York Times newspaper. My next reading is titled, National Association of Black Bookstores Launches. This was written by Claire Kirch and published August 6, 2025 at the website publishersweekly.com. The National Association of Black Booksellers, or NAB2, a member-based nonprofit organization which aims to support and promote black booksellers, announced its launch on Friday, August 8th. Its mission, NAB2 said, in the announcement, includes promoting literacy, amplifying black voices, and preserving black culture. A NAB2 representative will staff a table this fall at all of the regional bookseller conferences, introducing the organization to booksellers and processing memberships, which have three tiers in fees ranging from $100 to $500. NAB2 was founded by Kevin Johnson, the owner of Underground Books in Sacramento, California, who is also a former professional basketball player and the mayor of that city between 2008 and 2016. The organization's board represents a mix of seasoned owners of historic stores and young booksellers who have opened stores in recent years. Among the board members are Ma'ati Prim of Marshall's Music and Bookstore in Jackson, Mississippi, founded in 1938, and Yvonne Black of Hakim's Bookstore in Philadelphia, founded in 1959, as well as Onika Asamoah Caesar of Fulton Street Books and Coffee in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Derry Landry of Class Bookstore in Houston, both founded in 2020. Other board members include some of the most prominent names in bookselling: Jordan Harris of Alkibu Land Images in Nashville, Janet Webster Jones of Source Booksellers in Detroit, Blanche Richardson of Marcus Books in Oakland, California, and Troy Johnson of African American Booklit Club in Tampa, Florida. Author Lucille O'Neill, best known as the mother of former basketball player Shaquille O'Neal, is also a board member. Johnson says that he was inspired to launch NAB2 to honor his mother, Mother Rose Pete West, who founded Underground Books in 2003 and died in December. I wanted to start NAB2 to honor her legacy because she cherished black bookstores and wanted to see them thrive, he told Publishers Weekly. My goal in helping to found the organization was to bring the experts together, couple them with significant resources, and ensure that communities could reap the benefits of Black bookstores for generations to come. Johnson was adamant that Black booksellers should not consider membership in NAB as an alternative to membership in the American Booksellers Association, which has recently come under fire for not addressing the concerns and needs of Black booksellers. In response to those criticisms, which came to the fore during a contentious community forum at Winter Institute 2024 in Cincinnati, the American Booksellers Association sponsored pre-conference programming just for Black, Indigenous, People of Color booksellers at Winter Institute 2025 in Denver and Children's Institute in Portland. Johnson said that he and his team have been in discussions with the American Booksellers Association executives about potential partnerships. We look forward to collaborating with them to further both organizations and bolster the strength of Black bookstores everywhere, he said. NAB2 board members are in full agreement that Black booksellers need an organization that addresses their unique needs. Jones told Publishers Weekly that NAB2 is an effort to pull together Black booksellers and stores in an overarching organization that would not just advocate, but also partner with other aspects of the industry. She pointed out that there has been a surge in the number of Black entrepreneurs opening bookstores, and that there are essential resources offered by the ABA in Ingram, as well as other organizations serving the industry that these new booksellers might not know about. We want these new bookstores to use the resources that are just waiting for them, Jones said. NAB2 can help them with all that. This organization can support and assist in ways we haven't even figured out yet. Landry told Publishers Weekly that she has witnessed firsthand how vital bookstores are to our communities, not just as places to buy books, but as cultural hubs, safe spaces, and sources of truth and empowerment. I think NAB2 is necessary because it helps connect us, amplifies our collective voice, and reminds us that we are not doing this work in isolation. We're part of a larger legacy, one rooted in literacy, liberation, and love for our people. NAB2, she added, helps preserve that legacy and make sure we're resourced, protected, and supported in this industry. Jones and Landry both emphasized the potential of NAB2 as a vehicle to make the industry more accessible, not just for Black booksellers, but also Black authors and readers. Distribution, they both pointed out, is a key component in achieving this goal. Landry said she and others affiliated with NAB2 are committed to making it easier for independent Black-owned stores to get access to the titles our readers are hungry for, while also lifting up independent Black authors who often struggle to get shelf space. Representation matters at every level. The American Booksellers Association registered its own enthusiasm for the new venture as well, with Communications Director Ray Daniels expressing excitement at the ways that our industry is evolving to ensure that Black booksellers and Black-owned bookstores are supported and valued. He added, "Several ABA members are founding board members, and we look forward to working with their organization." That was the article, "National Association of Black Bookstores Launches." It was written by Claire Kirch and published August 6, 2025 at the website publishersweekly.com. My final reading of the day is an essay which will take up the remainder of the program. It's written by Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr., who's most popularly known as the host of the PBS program Finding Your Roots. This essay is about author Jamaica Kincaid. It's titled Suddenly Jamaica, and it was published in the August 21st, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books magazine. Girl, Jamaica Kincaid's first published short story, appeared in June 1978 in The New Yorker, a magazine I could find time for only during summer vacation when I would lie in my parents' backyard and read each issue straight through, or at least I would try to. I seemed to have stumbled on Girl without glancing at its author's name. I had just submitted my doctoral thesis at Cambridge and was anxiously awaiting word of its approval, which would allow me to become an assistant professor of English and Afro-American Studies at Yale. Exhausted by the ordeal, I found leafing through those splendid pages to be welcome relief. I knew that in the magazine's weekly short story, I would find style and literary titillation. I wasn't expecting to find work that exploded my sense of what fiction could achieve. At Cambridge, neither African nor African-American literature was a part of the English curriculum. I don't think it occurred to anyone that either ever would be. It was understood that we wouldn't write dissertations about living writers, let alone those who were black. Wole Soyinka, the future Nobel Prize laureate from Nigeria, had been denied a visiting appointment in the department the year I arrived, ostensibly because African literature was not English literature. The undergraduate curriculum focused on the practical criticism of English and American poetry and the history of tragedy, beginning with the Greeks. I'd been assigned to teach a class on the Afro-American novel. During college at Yale, in this category, I'd read only Richard Wright's Native Son, published in 1940, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, 1952, and Jean Toomer's Cain, 1923. So I was essentially starting from scratch. I began my reading with Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, 1970, and Sula, published in 1973. Then moved on to James Allen McPherson's Hue and Cry from 1968, Ishmael Reed's wildly original satire Mumbo Jumbo from 1972, Leon Forrest, There is a Tree More Ancient Than Eden from 1973, Charles Johnson's Faith in the Good Thing, published in 1974, Gail Jones' shape-shifting Corregidora, published in 1975, David Bratley's 1975 novel South Street, and Reed's parody of the slave narrative genre Flight to Canada, published in 1976. Novice though I was, I could see from this self-imposed syllabus that African-American literature was in the midst of something of a renaissance, a burst of vigorous creativity from a younger generation of writers. Each was, it seemed to me, intentionally and rather self-consciously, extending Ellison's tradition of literary modernism. In his twist on the Bildungsroman, Ellison had his nameless protagonist write himself into being, describing how he sheds the identities that have been forced upon him. This was distinct from Wright's more strident naturalism. Unlike Ellison, Wright used third-person narration to present static protagonists who were doomed from birth by the unyielding, totalizing forces of racism and capitalism. In Wright's work, black politics play out through literary form. Aesthetic value is inextricably tied to theme, to message. Perhaps it is not surprising that practitioners of black aesthetic critical theory, especially Addison Gale, championed Wright's work at the expense of Ellison's. Ellison never forgave the insult. His best friend, Albert Murray, coined the phrase, the social science fiction monster, in part to describe the naturalism of authors like Wright. Having come of age in the 60s, I witnessed Martin Luther King Jr.'s movement to end segregation yield to the separatist politics of Stokely Carmichael's Black Power movement. By the early 70s, Black Power and the corresponding Black Arts movement, associated especially with writers like Amiri Baraka, had peaked. Baraka and his cohort expressed great resentment toward Ellison, whose invisible protagonist winds up living in a hole. They saw him as the embodiment of the anti-revolutionary, in contrast to Wright and his visceral action man, who, we must remember, accidentally murders a white girl, then cuts off her head and sets her corpse ablaze. In my graduate school years, I saw a new body of work by African-American writers, especially black women like Morrison and Alice Walker, emerging. These writers were concerned as much with form, aesthetic quality, and self-expression as they were with themes like black liberation or the fight against white racism. By the time I submitted my dissertation, A new generation of critics have begun the search for a language worthy of this dramatically new literature. I will never forget a conversation I had around this time with the venerable scholar Eleanor Traylor, a close friend of Morrison, Maya Angelou, and James Baldwin, who would later become the chair of the Department of English at Howard. She remarked to me that it was time for black writers to assume their propositions and stop feeling the need to claim them. By this she meant that they should make the fact of their blackness the default and write about what it means to be a human being who also happens to be black or not. Black writers should stop feeling the need to plead our people's case, she said, or to refute centuries of racist dogma about our supposed natures and get on with making literature. This struck me straight away with enormous force. Yes, leave the revolution making to politicians and activists. It was with her charge in my subconscious that, not a year later, I discovered Girl. This is how to make a good medicine for a cold. This is how to make a good medicine to throw away a child before it even becomes a child. This is how to catch a fish. This is how to throw back a fish you don't like, and that way something bad won't fall on you. This is how you bully a man. This is how a man bullies you. This is how you love a man. And if this doesn't work, there are other ways. And if they don't work, don't feel too bad about giving up. This is how to spit up in the air if you feel like it. And this is how to move quick so that it doesn't fall on you. This is how to make ends meet. Always squeeze bread to make sure it's fresh. But what if the baker won't let me feel the bread? You mean to say that after all, you are really going to be the kind of woman who the baker won't let near the bread? It would be difficult for me to exaggerate my astonishment at this story. This was a long way from Native Son, to be sure. Was the author black? Could this author be black? She had, with great determination, refused to say what she was. There were clues, certainly, but very subtle ones, such as dishes like pumpkin fritters and food like saltfish, and something that one sings called benna, B-E-N-N-A. But her reader could learn the meaning of that only by looking it up. This author was not pandering to a white reader, or, for that matter, to a non-Caribbean one. The world she had created was self-contained. Only the author's first name, Jamaica, surely a nom de plume, convinced me that she could be a black woman. For a brief moment, I have to confess, I wondered whether she was a white woman who was trying to put us off the trail. Nobody could actually be named Jamaica. Jamaica's penchant for assuming the blackness of her characters without saying so, in the same way that white writers assume the whiteness of their characters without saying so, seems to me to have been a major departure from the history of African American literature. This approach characterizes Onyeka's work too. The characters in his plays are primarily Yoruba, their world, Nigeria. The three fathers of African American literature in the post-war world, Richard Wright, James Baldwin, and Ralph Ellison, broke through the U.S. market's race barriers in the productive years following World War II, long after the Harlem Renaissance had become the stuff of literary history. For each of them, blackness was the great subject. Negro literature was necessarily defined as literature about Negroes written by Negroes, and mostly by and about Negro men, though Gwendolyn Brooks' Maud Martha, a proto-feminist novel, was shamefully undervalued when it was published in 1953. It was later resurrected by black feminist critics, starting with Mary Helen Washington in her pioneering anthology, Black Eyed Susans, in 1975. On the very first page of Native Son, Wright tells us that light flooded the room and revealed a black boy standing in a narrow space between two iron beds, rubbing his eyes with the backs of his hands. His memoir, of course, was called Black Boy. Baldwin, Wright's protege, who went on to slay him at the crossroads of naturalism and modernism, conveyed the race of his characters on the first pages of his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, published in 1953, writing of the congregants at his evangelical Temple of the Fire baptized. A round black man named Deacon Braithwaite, a genial well-fed man with a face like a darker moon. John watched the black skin glisten while they lifted up their arms and fell on their faces before the Lord. Meanwhile, the very conceit of Ellison's Invisible Man is the failure to tell one's own story. Granted, Wright, Baldwin, and Ellison had little choice but to depict the blackness of their characters explicitly. Many of their books were written during Jim Crow segregation, the nadir in American race relations. Considering what was politically demanded of black literature during the desperate struggle against anti-black racism under Jim Crow, maybe it's not surprising that, in works from black writers of the period, a character's blackness is clearly marked. Take a look at Jamaica's more immediate literary antecedent, Morrison, whose Song of Solomon was published in 1977. In that novel, Morrison uses the word black to describe her characters about 40 times. In November 1983, The New Yorker published Jamaica's The Circling Hand, certainly one of my favorite short stories in English literature, in which the practice of assuming propositions is on magnificent display. Later, it was published as a chapter of Annie John. Its subject is on the onset of adulthood, and the incursion of the adult realm of desire into the pure world of childhood, which breaks the intense bond the child, Annie John, a fictionalized version of Jamaica herself, has until then had with her mother. The story opens with a memory of her and her mother taking a bath together. Later, arriving home early from school one afternoon, she witnesses a scene of intimacy between her mother and father, and for the first time she becomes a stranger to her mother and herself. When I got to our house, I rushed into the yard and called out to her, but no answer came. Then I walked into the house. At first I didn't hear anything. Then I heard sounds coming from the direction of my parents' room. My mother must be in there, I thought. When I got to the door, I could see that my mother and father were lying in their bed. It didn't interest me what they were doing, only that my mother's hand was on the small of my father's back, and that it was making a circular motion. But her hand, it was white and bony, as if it had long been dead and had been left out in the elements. It seemed not to be her hand, and yet it could only be her hand, so well did I know it. It went around and around in the same circular motion, and I looked at it as if I would never see anything else in my life again. If I were to forget everything else in the world, I could not forget her hand as it looked then. I could also make out that the sounds I had heard were her kissing my father's ears and his mouth and his face. I looked at them for I don't know how long. That same autumn, in 1983, I was offered a chaired professorship in English at Cornell. In my own writing, I was beginning to piece together the formal relationship between Invisible Man and Mumbo Jumbo through a study of signifying in black vernacular. I was intrigued by how black writers riff on one another, like links in a chain of tradition, how they represent blackness, from whom and through whom. It was clear that black writers read and revised one another while often pretending that they had not, claiming paternity from white fathers, never black ones like Ellison did, to bypass Wright's clear influence on him. For Wright, all Negroes were black. Morrison, on the other hand, seemed intrigued by the range of browns that actually color our skins. For all of Ellison's unpopularity during my youth, many towering black writers who came after him, Morrison, Colson Whitehead, Jamaica herself, followed in the tradition of his modernism. Wright, who was loudly championed by black aesthetic critics in his lifetime, has fewer important descendants, though I would consider Sapphire and Kesey Lehman, as well as rap artists like N.W.A. and Chief Keef, to be his heirs. I don't think that any black writer before Jamaica had successfully foregrounded a very small episode in a character's life in order to reveal the complex discovery of his or her humanity. A certain inevitable alienation between mother and daughter in The Circling Hand, without in some way tying it to the much larger question of black-white race relations. Never before. Revealing this emotion between mother and daughter is what The Circling Hand is about. It is not about a black mother and her black daughter on some island, difficult to pronounce correctly, floating somewhere in the Caribbean. It is about itself, an act of language, first and foremost. And that is both an astonishing fact and an astonishing achievement. We must write less of issues that are particular and more of feelings that are general. The freeborn black poet Frances Ellen Watkins Harper pleaded in a letter to Thomas Hamilton, the august editor of the Anglo-African, in 1861. We are blessed with hearts and brains that compass more than ourselves in our present plight. But suddenly came Jamaica, a striking voice, mordant, irreverent, unremitting and generous. She blends reportage and personal experience with a deep understanding of history, showing how events out there can be felt in here. Dear Mr. Crusoe, please don't come. She wrote in a new edition of Robinson Crusoe in 2019. She laughs at the things that were meant to frighten her. Once, she wrote in Rolling Stone in 1977, as I was walking down a street and just about to pass a man, he said to me, "Hey, sugar, you coming at me like a fresh-baked cake." When I didn't say anything but kept on walking, he crept up behind me and whispered in my ear, "Speak, devil, speak." I looked at him and I laughed out loud. I wanted to read more, and so I did. I knew that I wanted to meet this writer, to speak to her about what she was up to. In the 1986-1987 academic year at Cornell, my colleagues and I invited her to give a reading. I remember that as she emerged from my car for dinner, she was quite taken by our garden. When I moved down to Duke in 1989, I invited her again, and almost as soon as I was hired to rebuild the Department of Afro-American Studies at Harvard, hers was our first long-term appointment. Determined as I was to study and even celebrate great black writing, who else would I have turned to first? I am proud to say that we have become friends. Shortly after I published my memoir, Colored People, in 1994, Jamaica invited me to give a joint reading at her place of worship, Congregation Beth El in Bennington, Vermont. And when my wife and I purchased our house in Cambridge nearly 10 years ago, Jamaica insisted on designing our garden. Gardens have become one of Jamaica's major themes, along with race, racism, colonialism, and literature itself. I believe each of these themes could be subsumed in her work under the maternal, the biological, the colonial, and the social. Without question, her great subject is her mother, Annie Victoria Richardson. Annie gave birth to Jamaica in St. John's, Antigua, on Wednesday, May 25th, 1949. She named her Elaine Potter Richardson. Jamaica learned that she was born out of wedlock when she realized, she wrote me recently in a letter, that I was christened on a Thursday, not a Sunday, because I was an illegitimate child. The English colonial practice. Monday's child is fair of face. Tuesday's child is full of grace. Wednesday's child is full of woe. Thursday's child has far to go, as the English nursery rhyme goes. Annie was 30 when her daughter was born, the first of four children. Jamaica suspects that her mother was so old by Antiguan standards because she had cleaned out her womb, that is, had an abortion or several. Annie was born in Dominica. Jamaica's father, Roderick Potter, was an Antiguan taxi driver and chauffeur whom she barely knew. Jamaica told me that she doesn't know how her parents met. Annie never told her. I do know, she wrote me, that when she was 7 months pregnant with me, she took money he was saving up to open his own business and left him. He seemed to have held me responsible for that, and along with other reasons, colonial law for one, his name does not appear on my birth certificate. The column where his name should be has a line in black ink drawn through it. Jamaica was raised in St. John's by her mother and the man who would eventually become her stepfather, David Drew, a cabinet maker. Annie doted on Jamaica when she was a child, taught her to read, made her clothes, and ensured that she received an education. She became a leading character in her daughter's work, from Annie John, published in 1985, to Mr. Potter, published in 2002. In Jamaica's collected nonfiction, the word mother appears over 300 times, the phrase my mother over 200 times. Jamaica's relationship with her mother changed after the birth of her three brothers in 1958, 1960, and 1962. She wrote that her mother lost interest in her and instead spent her time caring for her sons and her ill husband, who was suffering from heart and digestive problems. Her resentment grew when she was removed from school, first to help out at home, and then in 1965 to move to the United States to work as an au pair in Scarsdale, New York. Her mother ordered her to send money home. Jamaica refused. In My Brother, published in 1997, the narrator's mother burns all the books hidden around their house in a fury at her daughter for insisting on reading rather than helping her. We feel the powerful ambivalence that the relationship generates. Then again, Jamaica wrote in Harper's in 2009, after saying that she was not thinking of her mother, "I am always thinking of my mother. I believe every action of a certain kind that I make is completely influenced by her, completely influenced by her realness, her existence in my life." In their estrangement, Jamaica didn't see her mother for 20 years, until her daughter, whom she named Annie, was born, remains throughout her nonfiction the source of a deep and abiding grief. It is the major condition of her work. It is into that breach that she writes. The force of Jamaica's self-scrutiny spreads to her other themes, even outside to the garden. Following a New Yorker tradition created by Catherine White, the magazine's first fiction editor and the wife of E.B. White, she wrote a regular column, In the Garden, for the magazine from 1992 to 1996. She published My Garden Book in 1991, Among Flowers in 2005, and last year with Kara Walker, An Encyclopedia of Gardening for Colored Children. The gardens she writes about are full of bright hibiscus flowers and also danger under the feet. In My Brother, she writes to the red ants that, on her brother's first day of life, climbed up on an okra plant and threw an open window into the house and attacked him. It was no surprise to me, she writes in The Disturbances of the Garden, published in 2020, that my affection for the garden, including its most disturbing attributes, its most violent implications and associations, is intertwined with my mother. As a child, I did not know myself or the world I inhabited without her. She is the person who gave me and taught me the word. Jamaica spelunks into the mud of racism, colonialism, and even global appropriation. Shame is a lightning rod for her, but with a sublime intimacy, in a voice that calls her reader in without the self-important scaffolding that we find in Wright, Ellison, and Baldwin. One might say that her work is self-consciously modest, that her fiction never grandstands. It gets to the marrow of how motherhood, childhood, and femininity are denied by colonialism, certainly, but it does so by illuminating the struggle simply to become a human being. I think this is why Jamaica has never felt she needed to mark her characters by race. The irreverence. What can be more irreverent than quarreling so consistently in public with one's mother? Humanity, vulnerability, and modesty of her offering amount to something quite special, something primarily literary and not primarily political. Her work isn't even secondarily political. Even when she writes about the most vexed of ministerial matters, such as the effects of colonialism on her native Caribbean, the urgency of the fight against racism, sexism, and colonialism never upstages the urgency to plumb the depths of being alive. In The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois described a double consciousness, an unnatural condition forced on the American Negro by this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. The metaphor has become one of the controlling notions in the African-American literary tradition. From perhaps its first repetition, Jane Weldon Johnson's Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, published in 1912, right through Morrison's Beloved, published in 1987. The cause of double consciousness, of course, is an almost totalizing anti-black racism that yields the American Negro no true self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. In Biography of a Dress, published in 1992, Jamaica depicts an almost primal moment of separation from herself, but through her mother, as her two-year-old self attempts to recover from the pain of having her ears pierced by two thorns that have been heated in a fire. Was that pain given by her mother intentional? A passing along of the pains of childbirth, perhaps? Or was that pain meant to express hostility or aggression toward me, but without meaning to and without knowing that it was possible to mean to? For days afterward, my earlobes were swollen and covered with a golden crust, which might have glistened in the harsh sunlight, but I can only imagine that now. And the pain of my earlobes must have filled up all that made up my entire being, and the pain of my earlobes must have been unbearable, because it was then that was the first time that I separated myself from myself, and I became two people, two small children then. I was 2 years old, one having the experience, the other observing the one having the experience. This self-division and Jamaica's consciousness of that division, because of her mother, is what gave her a voice and ultimately what proved liberatory in her work. That was the essay titled Suddenly Jamaica, written by Henry Louis Gates. This appeared in the August 21st, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books magazine. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.